Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and today I'm joined by Alistair Benn, who is the Deputy Editor at EI. Now, Alistair is an aficionado of the sport called rugby union, a genuinely global sport whose World Cup begins in France on Friday. I am not. So here we present an idiot's guide, me being the idiot and Alistair the guide, to the Rugby World Cup. So let's start, Alistair, with the basics. I mean, people who've got no idea of what rugby union is, how is it structured? What are its attributes, its qualities? How would you describe it to a complete novice?
I would say the three sporting attributes the game emphasises are speed of foot, an instinct for finding space and physical strength, and on top of that, wise decision-making, because it's a very, very complicated game with lots of moving parts, much more complicated than many other ball games, especially football.
Yeah,
it comes from England. And I think to give an idea of how the structure of rugby has developed into the form that it's played in now, you have to go back to the beginnings. Mm-hmm. So in almost all cultures, there are ball games which involve people running into each other or trying to stop each other with their arms or their shoulders or whatever and chucking a ball around between them. So, you know, in Japan, you have Kamari, yep. Georgia, Lalo Berti. In Scotland, particularly in the Borders, a game called Jeddah Bar.
And you have those great games played in Northern Italy as well that are notorious for their violence.
Exactly. And actually, rugby is actually proved pretty popular in parts of the world in which they have a strong pre-existing culture of contact sport.
And this was, like so many sports that are global now, that are popular now, this was codified in Victorian Britain during the 19th century.
It comes from various variants of ball games, not dissimilar from football.
Yep.
So in the 19th century, you have a real variety of games in which, as I said, people are running into each other, chucking the ball to each other. And the balls are different shapes because we don't have a standard. The game sort of develops particularly in the public schools in the 19th century. And famously, well, I mean, the great founding myth of rugby is this idea that a schoolboy called William Webb Ellis...
He was at rugby.
At rugby. Was playing football and he picked up the ball and ran with it and put it over the line. And that's how a try was scored, which is the part of rugby which gives you the most points.
And this is the mythology that diverts. This is a kind of diversion from football, what other people call soccer, which is a game principally of the feet, to the game of rugby, which is principally one of the hand. Of course, there is kicking in rugby, but it is essentially one where you handle the ball.
Exactly, which I actually think lends rugby its peculiar sort of spectacle and sort of almost its glory, that the players can be sprinting at absolute full pace, whereas in sport, footballers may be sprinting, but they are, after all, constrained by the ball at their feet.
Now, speaking as an idiot, there is one point about that division between football and rugby, both rugby league and rugby union. We're talking about rugby union here, which is the shape of the ball.
Yeah.
In football, where the ball is round, there's less an element of chance when it bounces. I've always been quite intrigued by the weird shape of the rugby ball. It's also shared in Australian rules football, of course, and rugby league as well. Is this, when it drops, the very shape of the ball introduces an element of chance that's not there with a round ball. Does that have any significance on the way the game is played?
Because that introduces that kind of chaos. And I think what you're alighting on is that rugby, of all sports, it kind of clarifies this contest that happens in a lot of sports between serendipity, chaos, and structure. At its best moments, it can embody a kind of melding of a kind of spectacular chaos with a kind of infinitely beautiful structure, played by big men, well, and women, but by in the World Cup that's coming up, by men running at extraordinarily fast speeds, physically strong, in patterns which are delicate, which are highly structured, but also have a capacity to let people make their own decisions and innovate. And how we got to the modern game of rugby is actually a really fascinating story. As we talked about, it starts off in the early 19th century. It's one ball game among many. And in fact, one of the oval ball is there almost right from the beginning. I think there's some records in some of these early public schools where they talk about the ball in this shape. And I think it has something to do with the pig's bladder it's shaped around, which doesn't fit neatly into a ball. Mm-hmm. And all these variants start becoming really popular in the schools. What then happens is rugby becomes very, very popular across England, and particularly in working class communities. Immensely popular in a way that we probably wouldn't be able to gauge now because rugby has developed in such a different direction. So lots of people are playing something that pretty much approximates what we'd think about of rugby, give or take, the different rules. What happens then is that codification rules start to be put onto the sports by the kind of the powers that be, the Rugby Football Union. And there are several things that happen. The idea of the penalty gets created, and rugby is a curious sport in that it's often the case that about half of the points in a game come from penalties, which are sanctions on someone breaking the rules.
Yep.
That's not true of any other game, where penalties are an exceptional device.
In part because the rules are so complicated.
The rules are so complicated, but the penalty system gets constructed by the authorities, who are also interested in keeping the game as an amateur sport. Mm. They don't like what it's become in the working class communities as a raucous spectacle, where men also expect to be paid for what they're doing.
Yeah,
people at the top of the sport don't like that. Yeah.
And this comes back to that phrase, well-known phrase, cliche perhaps, that, football is a gentleman's game played by ruffians, whereas rugby is a ruffian's game played by gentlemen. And this idea of gentlemen and players is quite deep in English sport in particular. It certainly had it with cricket. There was a long division between the gentleman amateur and the professional player, which was often a division between the batsmen, who were the gentlemen, the bowlers, who were the players. But rugby union is an outlier in this because it remained an amateur sport, even at the very highest level. And there's many people who would argue that the game in the 1970s, for example, was played at just about the highest level it's ever been played. But it only turns professional in 1995. So why is that?
Well, again, you've got to look at the structure of how it developed early on. So what happened in the 1880s and the 1890s is the northern clubs in England basically begin to operate a de facto professional game.
And this is rugby league, what is now called rugby league.
Well, that is what it then develops into. Yeah. So, but
Which is professional.
Exactly. But what they're then playing is union. So the northern clubs... there are all kinds of experts. Historians will say that, in the working class community, sport has a different flavour. There's a bias towards entertainment, towards spectacle, that rest, and that favours professional athletes playing at the top of the game. And as opposed to the amateur game, which favours interpretation of rules, fair play, playing to the rules of the game. I don't know how far to push those kinds of analogies, but that's certainly something that has been stimulated by this debate. So
and
what
a fair amount of hypocrisy there on class terms.
A huge amount of hypocrisy, but rugby it's got so much sort of symbolic, it's got sort of weighty symbolic meaning when you sort of get into it, partly because of its very complex relationship to the class structure and class consciousness in England in particular.
Yeah.
So, and then the northern clubs, basically, there's a huge hoo-ha. the RFU says, no, you're not going to get around this and start playing players or get, you know, Northern clubs had developed this idea called broken time, where players would be reimbursed for missed work as a kind of way of, you know, de facto doing professionalism. And the RFU says, no, in 1895, they say, no, that's not allowed. The Northern clubs then create their own competition, which then in 1922, is renamed as the Rugby League.
Which is now very popular in Australia, of course.
Yes.
The main sport in Australia, along with Australian rules football.
Yes, and English sports, or English rugby in particular, has always actually been hampered by this division because it's never been able to draw on the full talents available to it throughout the country. You know, other sports which have fewer contact ball games, which don't compete against each other, have everything available. South Africa, for example, where also the kind of working labouring class was involved in rugby right from the beginning. New Zealand, where league is basically marginal.
And Australia, Wales is a classic example.
Wales is also a classic example. And Australia is the country which is most similar to England in that union is only plays in New South Wales.
And it's essentially a middle class game as well.
Is a marginal sport within Australia.
Even though they've managed to win two World Cups.
Yes, because they had a sort of sublimely talented... they're great innovators, Australia. So there's always this emphasis on backs play. Very innovative approach to the way runners work off each other. A lot of great intelligence there. But it's interesting that Australia gets that division. And I wonder if it's the fact that Australia is more plugged into what's going on in the metropole in the late 19th century. So innovations like league come into Australia much faster and more diffused than in other parts of the empire.
More marginal parts. But I just wanted to say that... So the World Cup began in 1987, the first of these World Cups. There is an attempt to create what is now a genuinely global sport, even though much of it follows the pattern of former dominions, former imperial places. It is, in a sense, a cricket is, though in different nuances, an imperial game, a game of Britain's imperial legacy. So the first of these took place in 1987, when rugby union was still 8 years away from being professionalised. So we're now coming up to the 10th World Cup, I believe. Can you just give us a focus of who've been the dominant powers? I mean, when I look as an outsider, obviously New Zealand is a major player, perhaps the major player in this sport, not least because its national identity is so dependent upon rugby union. The All Blacks are by far the most famous brand in New Zealand, in a way that's different from almost any other country, with the possible exception of Wales. Yeah. I think I don't think there's anyone who wouldn't see rugby union as the Welsh national sport. And as we've already pointed out, very intriguing, because unlike in England, Scotland, and perhaps Ireland, it's a working class sport in Wales. It's great dominance in the valleys, in Cardiff, in Swansea, in those places. Llanelli, very, very important. So you have these very different, there's cliches around each of these things. But if we think of the major players in the game, it's now expanded. You talk about Japan, Argentina and Uruguay have come on board. There are others like Georgia who have come on board. But the powers, the ones that we think of as teams, nations that could win this forthcoming World Cup, each seem to me to have different characteristics. Now, the host nation this year is France. Among the favourites, they are characterised by the old cliché of Gallic flair. There is something romantic that's always been there, almost more romantic, too romantic to win, in a sense. They're great entertainers, but not necessarily great victors. You have New Zealand, we've already mentioned. Australia, who punch above their weight, I think it's fair to say. England, who at the moment punch way below their weight. Mm. And you have the world's number one team now, which is Ireland. Yeah. And Ireland play as a united Ireland. It's all four provinces, Leinster, Munster, Ulster, and Connaught. Connaught's not much of a player. But they each have these very, very significant characteristics, which I think makes the game very interesting on a cultural level.
Yes. Some commentators have talked about it as the most truly Hegelian sport, the one that proceeds by, you know, through these kind of syntheses. So, like, you know, I mean, if you look at the history of the World Cup, South Africa have won it 3 times, New Zealand have won it 3 times, Australia have won it twice. Only one Northern Hemisphere team have won, England in 2003. So the Southern Hemisphere dominated. So, I mean, why is the Southern Hemisphere dominated? I mean, let's zero in on New Zealand, a country with a population. It always amazes me when I say this, given its prominence, actually, in the world stage, New Zealand's culturally and for all kinds of reasons. A population roughly half the size of Greater London.
Yes, it's extraordinary.
Can dominate. I mean, New Zealand and with its moniker, the All Blacks, have dominated the sport for extended periods in a way that is only comparable, really, to the way the West Indies dominated cricket for an extended period. It's an extraordinary thing to have achieved. Also in rugby, which is a game.
I'd put one other contender there is as a country that punches above its weight in sport historically. That's Uruguayan football. Yeah. We've won 2 World Cups quite a while ago now, but they remain quite a power. That's very, very unusual. Yeah. But I take your point.
But yeah, I mean, New Zealand, it's a massive source of national pride, particularly in the first half of the 20th century, where, you know, in New Zealand, there's this kind of notion of that New Zealand is a better Britain in New Zealand, which is very much associated with being having a greater affection for fair play, having been, you know, that there are these kinds of racial ideas that New Zealand has a better mix of the various constituent nations of the UK. So you've got this perfect melding of English, Scottish and Welsh talent and plus the indigenous and Maori element as well.
And this is a sport that is big, not just among New Zealand Maoris, but also among Pacific Islanders generally. It's very, very strong. Places like Fiji, Tonga.
Yeah. When we talk about rugby in terms of the flavour of the world game, it can be tempting to see it simply as the imperial game and a game played in the countries which the British Empire touched. Rugby has to some extent, it's played on every continent now, but it's to some extent developed away from that. France, which is the absolute sort of magnetic force at the heart of rugby. It's where all the money flows in. Mm-hmm. The club competition is the biggest, the wealthiest, almost the brashest and the best in quality. It pulls in players from all over the world to go and play there. The World Cup is being hosted by France. So many of the players in the smaller nations who will line up on the pitch, you know, in Marseille or whatever, will be playing at grounds they know well because so many of them are in the French league. They have huge pulling rights in terms of selling the TV rights. The fan base is extraordinarily well motivated and vociferous. So France is the kind of beating heart of rugby as it exists, and we've got to be honest. Rugby is struggling in some parts of the world. So this competition is really important. Again, the other sort of heart of rugby is the Pacific Islands, who make up a massively disproportionate. They contributed a massively disproportionate number of players to top teams around the world, including other countries. I mean, England has its Pacific Island contingent. Yeah. The same is true of just about every rugby nation.
Yeah.
So let's take Fiji, which is probably the most famous of the Pacific Islander countries. It's a tiny country, so under 1 million people. A British colony from 1874 until independence in 1970. And, you know, it's along with Tonga and Samoa, who are the other two Pacific Island teams who are competing at the World Cup. You know, these are the people who've contributed a huge amount. So, I mean, rugby, even in Fiji, is kind of interesting. So, they're sort of generally, broadly defined, there's like 2 ethnic groups in Fiji. They're indigenous Fijians, who are just over half the population. And then there are people who are the descendants of Asian immigrants who came in during the British era to work in factories, to labour, to work in the cities. So the indigenous population is massively overrepresented in Fiji in the military, police, public roles. The indigenous Fijians are massively Christian, you know, it's a very strong sort of Pentecostal, and that diffuses their rugby. you know, there's this, they have this, rugby is really part of the kind of ritual concept of indigenous Fijian identity. It's rugby players will often talk about ideas of kinship, vanua, they call it, which pervade the rugby field as they do in their family, their relationship with their god, everything. Rugby was introduced by the British in the military and in the public schools that they set up in Fiji. And it continues to play a huge social role in Fiji, and Pacific Islanders are blessed with extraordinary physical attributes, but there's also just this, like, everyone plays the game from a very young age. It's a bit like New Zealand, where everyone is very naturally gifted, very intuitive. But even in Fiji, rugby, as it is in many other parts of the world, including England, has a complex structure within society. It's not like football, which, let's be honest, has kind of gone past its class origins. It's now just such a part of the world's spirit, you know. Rugby is still part of these kind of local tensions, this relationship with the past. It's in constant dialogue with those things. I could talk about Scotland's very similar in some ways in that level as well, that there's a kind of class consciousness implicit with rugby.
Yeah, I mean, that really strikes me is when the English rugby team is talked about. I don't just mean the current English rugby team, which is plainly has its problems and is not expected to do well in the forthcoming World Cup. It may not even get out of its group. But I don't know of any other English sporting team, not the cricket team, not the football team, that is so widely hated as the England rugby team. And I don't mean it now, I mean always. There is a loathing of the English rugby team. I mean, almost within England itself in part, but certainly outside. What is that about? It's a kind of real visceral hatred of the England rugby team. And that's been there for a long time.
I wonder whether it's to do with the protection of amateur status, you know, this obsession with our game and protecting the structure of it. That's probably created a lot of antagonism. Rugby in England, I mean, it's got a lot of... It really is a sport of the professional classes. With two caveats, it is played in the Midlands. You think Leicester is a power of the kind of club game in England historically, and in the West Country. But that's mainly among...
With Bath and Bristol.
Yeah, but that's mainly among rural communities who are in the landowning class, whatever. Yeah. It's not... You know, the industrial working class game of the north of England is rugby league. Mm. And if you watch rugby league, I mean, in terms of ball handling, skill, power, everything, structure, rugby league was always, to go on a phrase, leagues ahead of union in its era. And a lot of the innovations since professionalisation in rugby that have come into union have come from league. Yeah. So more structured defence, a thing called rush defence, where you have kind of players coming up in a strong line. If you look at rugby 40 years ago, people didn't even do that. The backs moves they now do, a lot of them were developed in league, where people are used to kind of superior handling.
I mean, is that a good thing? Because one of the things that I noticed, if you look on YouTube, say, for instance, and you look back to the 1970s, the great Welsh team of the 1970s, with people like Barry John and Gareth Edwards and J.P.R. Williams, all those people, one is struck by the physical fragility of these people. I remember watching this in, say, the 70s or 80s, and one thought of rugby as, you know, game for, as you've said, you know, big people. But these look like waifs compared to the almost grotesque players of today. I mean, particularly forwards, they look, there's a kind of deformed nature of hookers and props, the people, you know, who go into the scrum. And there have been widespread concerns about the overwhelming physical nature of the game now and the lack of flow that perhaps the game has compared to in the past. And there's certainly been issues raised about head injuries with everything that we know about that. I mean, I think along with boxing, rugby is probably the sport where there's the greatest concern about head injuries and you know, dementia, that's caused by spread. I mean, that's a real problem for the game, isn't it?
There is a kind of symbiotic relationship with professionalisation. If you look at rugby in terms of the structure of the game, before 95, it doesn't change that much for decades. Mm. I mean, why would it? It privileges... I mean, you look at those archive footage, like that great Welsh team. That great Welsh team would be destroyed nowadays.
Yeah.
It wouldn't stand a chance.
But not through lack of skill.
Not through,
but through sheer skillful. Physical force.
But it's a much more elastic game. It's much more like Aussie rules, if you watch an Aussie rules game. It looks much more elastic. It looks almost much more, a little bit more confused, a bit more chaotic. That's what I'm talking about, is this kind of, rugby is this, at its best, is a kind of perfect blend of chaos and structure. Mm. But rugby since 95 has evolved very, very quickly. And absorbing those innovations from league is part of that. You know, that didn't happen before. Mm. The attraction of rugby union to players who have played rugby league, you know, is something that starts happening, especially in Australia and England, where, again, there's this obsession with harnessing all the you know, the whole population. Mm. And there's been a trade-off. It's at its best now, rugby. The very best games in the last decade. You know what? It's one of the great spectacles in all sport. I can't think of a sport which has as much visceral intensity. There is something, you know, having gone to quite a few professional rugby matches, that there is almost nothing like watching modern backs moves executed at speed, where, again, it's big men, skillful, you know, all that coming together. So, you know, I think rugby has a lot of problems with the head injury stuff, but that in itself is a kind of, you know, it's kind of a tension within the game. Rugby, it's so about this, it's so associated with the late Edwardian manly virtues, which one of those expected was extreme self-sacrifice. Mm. You know, I think that there's some great quotes from that era, the late 19th century, which comes up to the First World War. Headmaster of Loretto School in Scotland, H.H. Almond. Rugby, he said, produces a race of robust men with active habits, brisk circulations, manly sympathies, and exuberant spirit.
So what will we, if it, with this great spectacle coming up, first of all, predictions, who is going to win it?
I just sort of back France at home.
Okay.
Because, you know, if you look at the top 14, which is the French professional structure, it's remarkable how much home advantage affects the result.
But of course, there also comes pressure with that home advantage.
There is.
I mean, we've seen that in
But I think French teams always, they rise to it. They harness that emotion. They're massively proud. Again, just talk about the social base of rugby in France. Mm. It's really a southwest game. It's big farmer sort of thing.
But in that case, I, with my very amateur hat on, will say Ireland and possibly South Africa. Give us three players we should be watching out for who are going to be the great stars of this World Cup.
There have been injuries to some of the people who you might have expected to be the great stars. Romain Untermac, who's the French fly half, is a sublime player, but he's injured. So his replacement, Mathieu Jalibert, he could be a great star, incredibly talented guy. Almost, you know, in terms of his stats, is just as good as Untermac and may surprise people by, you know, driving France through the competition. Finn Russell, got to pick a Scots, given... sort of my heritage. I actually went to a school which has produced the most rugby internationals of any school in the entire world, which wasn't to prove my destiny, but it's such a big thing. It's kind of in Edinburgh and in their kind of surrounding areas. Finn Russell is Scotland's fly half, who plays the game. He plays the game with chaos. Like he's instinctive. He just trusts himself. And watching that in a rugby player, playing with freedom, expressing himself like that, that's really intoxicating. And I think illustrates something about Scotland, which has its own game, sevens, which is a code with only 7 players on the pitch, 14 players on the pitch at any one time, which has a massive premium on skill, on passing ability, on athleticism.
I think that reflects that group then.
That reflects that heritage. I mean, you know. So,
but surely the great star that everyone's focus will be on is Dupont.
Exactly.
He's your man. He's the Messi, the Ronaldo. You know, this is the man on whom all the pressure of not just France, as the French scrum half, but also in many ways rugby union itself, because like all those other sports, like cricket, it now lives so much in the shadow of football that there has to be that magical star who can sprinkle stardust on the pitch. And the consensus seems to be that DuPont is the man.
He's the captain as well of the team. So there's, you know, there's that as well. There's that added pressure. Mm. Well, but no, DuPont, he does things which no one else can do. A bit like Finn Russell. To me, they're very similar players, actually. You know, there's clear thinking, but there's also this kind of feel for the game.
And there's a romance as well. And I think we see that, you know, the great players, the really great players in any sport, fulfill themselves at World Cups. We saw that last year with Messi in the football World Cup. Lionel Messi, the greatest player on earth, won the World Cup with Argentina. DuPont, the greatest player of rugby at this moment, if he is really to fulfil that destiny, now is the time, in front of a home crowd. And we'd all be looking forward to it. So thank you for that, well, no longer quite such an idiot's guide to the forthcoming Rugby World Cup, which sounds very excited. I actually think, although the fact that France are favourites, there is real competition there. Obviously, I've mentioned South Africa, Ireland, the world's number one team. There really is, and South Africa, of course, there really is fierce competition, I think, for this trophy. I don't think it's very easy to call at all. So I look forward to it. And thank you, Alistair. And I hope everyone else will too. Thank you.